This is HPR episode 1960 entitled, Fosdem 2016 AW Building, and More. It is hosted by Ken Forlan, and is about 116 minutes long. The summary is, FreeBSD Matrix Train Uino Butter Knife Python Decore Boot Open Embedded Pico TCP PTX Dist Java Card Pro.
This episode of HPR is brought to you by AnHonestHost.com. Get 15% discount on all shared hosting with the offer code HPR15. That's HPR15. Better web hosting that's honest and fair at anhonesthost.com.
I'm here again with...
Hi, I'm Ed Mast. I'm a developer on the FreeBSD Foundation.
Okay, for those of us who doesn't know what the FreeBSD Foundation is, what is FreeBSD to start off with?
FreeBSD is an open source operating system that's been around for decades and is a widely used, permissively licensed operating system that's used for embedded appliances. It's used as an operating system on people's laptops and desktops, and its components of FreeBSD are used for people building other products and in all kinds of different ways.
So it's really truly come. It's a Unix for a start, and it comes back from the whole AT&T Berkeley thing. B is the Berkeley thing.
B is Berkeley, and yes, it dates back to the original, has a lineage through to original Berkeley Unix.
Okay, so most people, I guess, here on this are familiar with the whole. Well, we've had the GPL licensing interview, which people on listening to this will not have heard yet, but it'll be in the feed. So can you tell us from a licensing perspective what the difference is between, say, Linux and the BSDs?
So broadly speaking, the well-known GPL license says that if you make a derivative of the software, then you have to make those changes available in the source code as well. The BSD license and similar permissive licenses state that you can basically use the source code in different ways. You can make changes to it and produce a binary-only derivative of that source code if you like, or you can make changes to it and release the source code as well.
Okay, and that is what allowed Apple to take a BSD kernel and basically ship that without handing anything back to the community, I guess.
So it's true that someone like Apple is able to take components of FreeBSD and use them in Mac OS, but that doesn't affect FreeBSD itself, right? FreeBSD still exists, and FreeBSD continues to be a free operating system. And people like Apple contribute lots of money and developer time into projects like LLVM and Clang, the toolchain that we're using in FreeBSD now. So there's a lot of work that still happens in permissively licensed components across the spectrum, regardless of whether it's Apple or someone else doing that kind of work.
Okay, but the whole fact that you're developing your own compiler and getting away from the GCC, is that not like just simply a duplication of effort in order to get around the fact that you don't like the GPL as a license?
I wouldn't say that's the case. I mean, we in the FreeBSD community, we like Clang and LLVM for a lot of different reasons. It may well be that Apple was strongly motivated to do that because of their preference for non-GPL software. But from our perspective, I think it's very much the case that the GCC had stagnated a lot. The error messages specifically in GCC were in very, very poor shape. GCC's error handling was very difficult to make sense as a user. what it was trying to tell you. And Clang, when Clang came along, it really kind of invigorated the open source compiler world again. And Clang was producing much better error messages, and a lot of developers started using Clang because it was much easier for them to understand what the compiler was trying to tell them. GCC has improved immensely since this happened, but I think it's important not to have sort of a monoculture of software, whether it's the Linux kernel and FreeBSD or GCC and Clang, to encourage innovation to keep happening, and so that people can try out different things and go in different ways. And at this point, Clang and GCC are pretty much neck and neck for performance and for error messages and things like that. So really, there's just some different aspects that one is better in or the other is better in. And a lot of what we're really interested in FreeBSD, a lot of research areas, Clang really shines there.
Clang, what's GCC is like the compiler. What's Clang then in this chain?
So Clang/LLVM is the compiler in that family.
Okay, yeah. I had to ask that question. And obviously we saw in the browser wars, when IE1, it was just stagnation until Firefox came along. So can you explain to me for people not familiar, what the different variants of BSD are? How, I think a lot of our contributors will be familiar with, like, you got Debian, you got Fedora. Can you just give us I know distributions isn't the right words, but variants of BSD and why FreeBSD is the best, obviously.
So there are three main, well-known, BSD distributions, FreeBSD, OpenBSD, and NetBSD. Yeah. And then there's another set of ones that are a little bit, less popular perhaps, or newer. So they haven't had as much time to develop. And this is things like Dragonfly BSD, yeah, which split off from the FreeBSD project. And there's this sort of meme that, dates from the early days of the BSD community that OpenBSD was focused on security, NetBSD was focused on portability, and FreeBSD was focused on performance. Yeah. And I mean, I think, there's a grain of truth to that. These sorts of memes don't start for no reason, but, all of the projects now are focused or are put effort into all of the areas, of course. And so it's not fair to say that no other BSD cares about security or no other BSD cares about portability. So FreeBSD, we've been doing lots of interesting security research in ways that will show up in the future. And we've been looking at expanding to target different platforms as well. So we've brought up 64-bit ARM in FreeBSD recently, and we've just completed the kernel support now for our RISC-V port. And so we're really interested in looking at other architectures as well now. FreeBSD is by far, I think, the largest in terms of, if you want to call it market share. But all of the BSDs have unique attributes and a set of really loyal followers who are focused on each of them. So it's not like there's any sort of rivalry between us. We're all sort of in the same family, and just have a slightly different approach to some things.
Okay. Could I, for instance, take FreeBSD, pop it on my laptop, and expect to be able to do my daily grind?
Yeah, I think it's, broadly speaking, that's the case. There's a derivative of FreeBSD called PCBSD, which is designed for exactly that. It's designed to be an end user focused.
So when you say derivative, do you mean that it's a separate project, or is it under the umbrella of FreeBSD?
It's not part of the FreeBSD project per se, but PCBSD really is. It's FreeBSD under the hood. Yeah. Really what, the way I think about it is I kind of think about it as, opinionated FreeBSD. So in other words, it's FreeBSD, but instead of saying you can use this or this or this, window manager, or you can use this or this or this, it's sort of, all the choices have been made and set up and ready to go. You don't need to look through all kinds of configuration options and try and figure things out. It's ready to use out of the box.
Okay, fantastic. We just came out of a presentation by Leonard Pottering and with the, his systemd and stuff. Do you have any opinions on that?
So I'd like to thank Leonard for systemd, because it has certainly brought a lot of focus to the BSD community now. We've been picking up a lot of interest from people who are perhaps upset about the way the Linux world has developed with systemd. I think there are actually a lot of really good ideas in something like systemd, and I think we've been looking at when I say we, I mean the FreeBSD project. People in the FreeBSD project have been looking at different kinds of equivalent startup technologies. So things like LaunchD, someone has tried a port of that for FreeBSD, and there's a few other projects with exploring similar ideas. I think it's fair to say that there's a lot of value in something like that in a end user focused desktop or laptop type operating system. I think it's a bit of a challenge for us in the FreeBSD world, because a lot of systemd related components are becoming critical required pieces of the free software desktop story now. And so we're going to have to follow suit in some of those with some of those things, just to have a working desktop remaining on FreeBSD. But that said, I think there's a lot of good ideas and some more questionable ones, and I think the as is the case with the BSDs, we'll take a perhaps slightly conservative and careful view of the way this is developing, and see what is the best long-term approach for our user base.
Okay, very, very politically tactfully said, if I may say so. Before I get on to talking about the foundation, you did mention there about the free desktop projects, and I don't know, I get the sense that in the last few years that doesn't seem to be as important, not only to the distros, but to the various different people seem to be doing their own thing and going off, pursuing their own goals. Is that something that you as a project would like to focus more on, that, consolidating the start menus, that, the file menus is, Klaatu, who's been one of our hosts here on HBR, has been long lamenting the fact that you go to different, on the same system, you have 20 different file dialogues. Should they not all be the same? Or?
Yeah, I think that is, certainly that is something that free, software desktop, the free software desktop community, could do a much better job of consolidating those kinds of things. We're FreeBSD, we're very much the small fish in that community. And I think we're not really in a position to try and, drive those sorts of changes, significantly right now. For the longest time, there's been this impression that no one even, used, a desktop environment on FreeBSD. It was, we started, recently trying to talk to some of these other communities and reopen those lines of communication, because FreeBSD had long been, or the BSDs in general had sort of, generally speaking, been keeping to themselves, going to BSD conferences rather than broader free software and open source conferences. And we've made a conscious effort, a concerted effort now to try and come to these sorts of things. That's why I'm at FOSDEM here, is to try and, make contacts with people and have those, open up those sorts of discussions again.
So you're from the FreeBSD Foundation. Can you tell us a bit about that? What the, how it's organized? Is an elected position and stuff?
So the FreeBSD Foundation is a US 501c3 nonprofit. It's entirely funded by donations. And so that's corporate donations and donations from individuals. Typically our budgets hover around $1 million a year now. And that's a fairly recent thing. We had a much smaller budget, until the last couple of years. And we received a very generous, donation from Jan Koum, the, founder of WhatsApp. And so we've been able to expand what we do with the money that we raise. The foundation spends money on supporting BSD conferences, sending BSD FreeBSD developers to conferences like this one, outside of the original BSD sort of communities. The foundation spends money on legal support for the FreeBSD project, and we've ramped up some funded project development over the last couple of years as well.
Okay, very good. And what are you hoping to achieve here at the conference?
So I really want to try and make some contacts with other people in the free software world that have goals and projects that align with the sorts of things that we want to do in the FreeBSD project. And so one of the really interesting ones for me at the moment is the effort on reproducible builds. And so the Debian, a couple of Debian people have been driving this project recently. And it's something that we've had an interest in FreeBSD for quite a while as well. But being able to have those conversations face to face, it's much, much more effective to figure out that, hey, we have a lot of commonality here. We want the same things, and we can decide to work together on achieving the goals there.
And I say Debian and FreeBSD are not a million miles away from each other when it comes to stability and openness, I guess.
Yeah, I've had a few meetings with some Debian people, and you know, there's a lot of commonality and a lot of shared goals between us, and I hadn't realized actually that how much that was the case.
Yeah, they were trying to run a BSD kernel for a while. I'm not sure. Last year I was talking to them, they were having some trouble finding developers to help out with that.
Yeah, I'm actually familiar with that project. It's the Debian /KFreeBSD project, and it's actually I find it very, very interesting. I'm not 100% convinced that there are a large number of practical applications for it, but I think it's really interesting to me to sort of combine aspects of FreeBSD, the FreeBSD kernel, with the entire GNU Linuxy kind of user land. And for anyone who's coming from the Debian world and is used to apt and all the that sort of environment, I think it's really interesting that you can just bring up that same environment on a FreeBSD kernel. And FreeBSD has a container technology that's been around for a long time called Jails. And what's really interesting is that I can run a Debian installation in a jail on my FreeBSD laptop.
Oh, cool. Listen, I won't hog more of your time. Is there anything else that we should have covered?
I think that's probably it, but I would definitely encourage people to give PCBSD or FreeBSD a try and take it for a spin. I think you might find that you are surprised by what FreeBSD can do.
Excellent. Hi, everybody. This is Ken. I'm at the Matrix stand, and I'm talking to
Oddvar Løvaas.
Hi, so what is Matrix other than a movie?
Well, it's a open standard describing a communication protocol. I mean, all we're doing is basically sending JSON objects over HTTP. It's pretty easy. But what we want to create is an ecosystem where any app can talk to any other app. So we have a decentralized network of many servers, all of which can talk to each other. So basically, if you have your own server, which you can download a code and run yourself and join the federated network, and everyone is connected to that server, you know, your data stays on that server. But once you have more people from other servers in a group chat room, we then federate that data around and share it. So it's completely decentralized. In our main room, for example, there's about 300 servers that have joined, about 2,000 users over those. Whenever you send a message, that message gets, stored on 300 different servers rather than on a single server.
And when you say message, are we talking voice, text, data, video?
Yeah, I mean, all we're sending is JSON objects, so you can send whatever you want. We're kind of focusing on messaging and voice and video because, one, it's a very fragmented space, like every single application is a silo and they don't talk to each other, but also it is a nice example to talk about. I mean, you can do this. You can use Matrix for something like IoT data, or you know, whatever data you want to send. If you have a program that needs to send some commands or some data, you can use Matrix for that. I mean, it doesn't have to be a chat platform, but it lends itself well for that domain as well.
Okay. So do you have like any out-of-the-box replacements for something like Skype or...
Yeah, I mean, you can literally take our code on GitHub and you go to matrix.org and just download it from there. It runs as a sort of replacement for IRC, if you like, or something like Slack. It does, you know, group chat, private rooms, public rooms. We do web and video call over WebRTC. We have... we're using FreeSwitch for conferencing, so you can have, you know, we have your team syncs over our own room. We support end-to-end encryption, so you can literally have your own server and encrypt all the data you're sending, which is, you know, you can make sure you read our server code to make sure you trust it, or you can write your own server and use that. So it's completely open, it's free software, and all we want for is for more people to use it.
Okay, are you a company or a foundation, or how are you making money, or how are you supporting the project?
So matrix.org is set up as a non-profit organization, we are working on this full-time, and we're sponsored by our parent company, who I guess is looking at this as a R&D project, and, you know, once it's successful, we can start having a hosted solution, and we can charge for that with the support and, you know, the Red Hat model. It's completely free. All the software is Apache 2 licensed, so you can literally take it and use it in any way you want.
And who's your parent company? Let's give them a shout.
Yeah, it's Amdocs, a big multinational company. They do different things for us than what we do, but it's really cool that they've decided to sponsor us for doing this project.
So. Awesome. So could I, how easy is this to install? Say I'm able to install a server. How do I get the server?
So yeah, this should be really nice to use instructions. The server is currently written in Python. If it's not easy to install, please let us know, because it needs to be as easy as possible. There is a Debian image, there's a repository even. It should really just be going to matrix.org on GitHub, following the README, and, to take about 5 minutes maximum.
Okay, and my daughter was Skyping me last night. She's fairly technical, but would she be able to install a client by herself?
Yeah, she definitely should. I mean, a client is really easy to install. It's literally just a JavaScript client, or you can have a command line clients. In fact, there's many clients you can use, but the one we've been working on is called Vector. It's on vector.im, and it's just a React JavaScript. So you can use the one we have on vector.im, or you can install your own and connect to any of your own server, or create a user on the matrix.org server. It should be really easy to use. And it has, you can literally do set up a call like you would do in Skype by clicking a button, and it would, reach out to any other Matrix-enabled client. So you could take the call on your phone or on your browser, or even in other services that we have bridged into. And we want to bridge into everything that has an API, basically. So currently we have a bridge to IRC, so you can talk to IRC users. We have a bridge to Slack. We have a bridge to XMPP. We basically just want everyone to be able to talk to everyone else without having to worry about which app they're on.
And how do you handle all the security implications of all of that?
So all the security is just done over TLS from the service to server, but obviously, as I mentioned, we have our own implementation, and end-to-end encryption implementation called Olm, which is based on, or is similar to the Axolotl algorithm written by the Tech Secure guys. So you can literally take use that and encrypt all the data you're sending. And because you can run your own server, you can completely trust that the data will, be encrypted all the way.
How can somebody get involved in the project, or is it limited to your own team?
Yeah, no, that's a good question. We are an open source project. I mean, we're a few guys being paid to work on it, but obviously we welcome contributions massively. We have tons of things to do if you want to help. The first thing you can do, and the best thing you can do, is just to use it. Like, use our vector.im client or any other client. Write your own client. Come and talk to us. Run your own server. Basically, anything, using Matrix is amazing. We just want more people's feedback and experiences, and then you learn from them what they want, and hopefully we can add that to it. But we already had lots of contributions. We have people adding like usability fixes, adding their own auth packages, so you can use something like LDAP instead of having... So it's really good to see the support from the open source community.
We do a monthly show where we go onto Mumble and we record the session. Is that something that I could replace? Not that Mumble is open source, obviously, but we've had some issues with the client. It might be nicer just to go, here's a URL if you ever want to join.
Yeah, I guess you could do that. I mean, you could set up a room and everyone... I mean, it is kind of like a PubSub subscription. Right? So you have a room, so you post stuff into that room, and everyone in... who are interested in that data, you know, just have join that room. So yeah, you could use it for something like that.
And then I can record the conversations.
You would probably have to write a small bot or something that would do that for you. But it's definitely something that should be easy to add. We already have something similar with the VUC group. I don't know if you're familiar with it, but basically we've already bridged into that. It's just it's a sort of Friday chat show every Friday at 7, I think. And yeah, so you can join that, which is usually on IRC, but you can join that via Matrix as well.
Very good. So anything new coming up this year or...?
Yeah, we have a lot of things to that we're working on. We just sort of finished guest access, which means you can actually use go into a Matrix room without signing up. You obviously don't get the full features, but it's really nice, so you can try it before you know sign up and all that stuff. So I mentioned end-to-end encryption. The work is done, but we still haven't pushed it into all the clients, and that's sort of next thing, and I think will be a really big value add. Literally your own encrypted encryption system.
Sad that we need it, but there you go.
Sorry?
It's sad that we need it, but there you go.
Well, that's true. Other things we're working on is to make our the client we're working on, there's tons of clients, but the client we're working on, which is called Victor, make it really nice and easy, because, it's nice to have lots of functionality, but it also needs to be really usable and, sexy to use it. And hopefully we're getting there. We've done a lot of CSS and JavaScript work in the last few months. Any feedback you guys have would be really good. You get a bit blind when you're working on a project for so long, so, it's really good to have fresh impressions from new users.
Okay, hopefully I'll do that this year. Thank you very much, and enjoy the rest of the show. I'm at the Brain Duino table, and your name is?
My name is Willie Doering.
And what is Brain Duino?
Brain Duino is a project where you have a shield for the Arduino Uno, also for the Arduino Pro Mini, that you can use to record brainwave activity and bring it to a computer to have a mirror to your mind.
I actually must admit I read up about this, and you have like a... do they call them hats or not hats?
Headsets. It's basically just very comfortable way of attaching the electrodes to the surface of your head.
Yeah. So right now you're wearing a headband.
Yeah.
What does that feel like?
So it's actually very, like I said, it's actually comfortable. It's just it has to lay on the surface of your skin, and so this like silver chloride electrodes, so they work dry.
Yep.
Usually, if you do a EEG, electroencephalography recording, you need a gel or something to have a good skin contact condition.
Yep.
But the way this is used, and the amplifier setup from the hardware is very special in this case, different than other people do it. But so this works pretty well with dry electrodes also. Right. So you can just put it on and sit and...
Rubber.
So like this is the old version we're using it, but now it's like
on his head. He's just taking it off with.
It's from a designer in Berlin. She made this for us, and so like this is very comfortable to wear. It's like cashmere, and it has also felt,
and it's got 1, 2, 3, 4, 5 different. You could imagine them as buttons.
Yeah.
Soft, comfortable metal buttons.
And it's actually the same principle also.
I didn't notice that. I thought that was just a hairband.
Okay. Yeah. So, it's the same principle, buttons maybe from a jacket or something.
Yeah, those, clip-on buttons that you have on the military type of uniforms, or the clip-in, with the two wires that you push the... A sort of metal pin in onto it. So that's how they're attached.
Right.
So you can take those off and wash it, I guess?
This is the thing. That's why we developed this. So you can, after time, you use it for a couple of times, and then you can just hang it out, actually, and because like a natural material, it stays actually very clean for a long time.
Okay.
But this, second generation and the third generation is we have want to integrate... Whoa. This one actually.
This is a lot more beta, I think.
Yeah, it looks like very hacky, but we actually had it running. Also, we have the right over there is also a different device. like this. But here we have active electrodes. That means this very short wire. And so you don't, because like a cable or something is like an antenna.
Yeah, so you would wear this like a headband on your head, and then there's a cable running down.
Yeah.
So what you're doing now is bringing the electronics into the headband.
Making everything just in the headband, yeah.
It would be slightly heavier, I imagine?
Yes, but that's the thing right now. So we're working on it.
I'll take photos of this and put them into the show notes,
There's also the other one. So we want to make this even smaller, like smaller components, but this of course has to be going to a manufacturer for this, and so that's why we're planning to make a Kickstarter in roughly 2 months, and so we can make it smaller, make it more affordable, because right now Masahiro, he's been developing this over 30 years, and now he's opened the technology, and but he has to do a lot of soldering, and a lot of people ask him to do this. But of course, you can imagine it takes a lot of time, and so that's why we want to make, just produce maybe 1,000 devices, so like then he doesn't have to solder so much.
Good plan.
And yeah, but basically, it's.
So with the sensors, then you get what?
What with the sensors?
What does it actually measure?
So it's really depending on where you put the electrodes. It's really, the principle is called electroencephalography, and it's a brain imaging since the 20s. So there's a good understanding over certain brain functions, and so what we can do, for instance, is to learn to optimize or to become aware of my own brainwave activity, and by doing that, so I can make a training to maybe calm down my mind or to focus, to learn how to focus better. This is like a replacement for, you know, a lot of children, they get Ritalin. This is a chemical. And so they found out you can have the same effects actually with neurofeedback training if you stay on it. And this really inspires me to work on this project. And also you can, for instance, control a robot or something. If you imagine left and right hand movement, this works with a very high accuracy actually. Then you have to place the electrodes, of course, to the motor cortex. So not in the frontal lobe, but a little bit more higher. But you can also, this is a flexible setup, so you can, this is the one we are shipping, that you can either have this with a main board.
So we're looking at a board that will fit over an Arduino, is it?
So you can connect with the Arduino Pro Mini, or no, this... Yeah, and then so this is a main board.
Yeah.
So like if you want,
it's about the size of a pie, I guess.
Yeah, if you wanted to use it in a box with a cable, you can do that. Or you say you want to make a headband with all the electronics around. And so the customer or the people who want to have it, they can choose by themselves what they want to do actually.
Okay, and you take this, you take the signals, and you process them using what?
The processing. It's a digital signal processing. So, the way we do it right now is, so we have waves, and how many times does a wave go up and down per second is the frequency, and then also how big is this wave is the amplitude, and so what we can do is we can unmix the signal and make it useful for us. So we can also make a statement: how awake are you? Are you drinking a lot of coffee, or did you do sport? Are you almost falling asleep? You know, this is very easy or very simplistic statement, but it can be very complex depending how we unmix the signal. We can also unmix this spatially. So
frontal lobe, motor cortex, sensory cortex. So is he looking at the presentation, which we'll link to in the show notes?
Sorry?
Is your presentation available on the internet?
Yeah.
I'll get a link and put it into the show notes after.
Sure. Okay. So this is just saying, it's just an example how we can process this and make it useful for us. And so as I said, you can think about moving your limbs and we can detect that. Or you have some sort of, the P300 means you show some pictures maybe, something that is relevant for you. Or you can make a spell computer. Let's say you think about the letter D, and it goes A, B, C, and then D. And you can detect you were thinking of this letter. So this is also for people who have this locked-in syndrome, who cannot move. And then you have this brain-computer interface, something you can use the Brainduino, actually. And then you can communicate with the outside world.
So for hacking accessibility issues, I guess. I see a lot of... You mentioned... replacement for brain issues, but also for... people who are have mobility issues, and yeah.
And also, like, I think there will be like a new generation of computer games actually, because so like this will not ultimately maybe depending on the game design, you can either still have a game controller, but then you can make the experience of the game even more deeper or more customized, actually the way you feel, you know, change things in the game environment depending on your mood, which is very interesting, I think. Like, imagine you do like the perfect horror game, so every time you relax too much.
No, I don't want to imagine that, but yeah, okay, go on.
But no, it could be also the opposite, you know, like every time you fear,
you're in a safe place,
then you have like little bunnies hopping around or something, you can trigger this maybe with a headset actually. Yeah.
So it's basically allowing you to start using this the electrical signals in our brains to do cool stuff, basically to go hacking. Now, how you're going to be doing a Kickstarter to get this off the ground, can you give me more info on that, costs and stuff? When it's going to be?
Because we have to do a lot of processing and a lot of organization right now, we plan to do this at least, let's say in 2 months around this time, or maybe 3 months, but definitely still this year, and I mean, still the first half. So the thing is, we're still in the process. So now we have a manufacturer, and now we also have to think about, because the nicest thing is, if we order something, you order this Brainduino, and you can just start from the box. You can just plug it in and then start. So that's why we have to think about a casing. That's still what we're processing right now. And then hopefully we have also some nice like we have advice from Mitch Altman, the founder of the hackerspace in San Francisco, Noisebridge. So he is helping us because he also did like a lot of open source hardware projects, we're very confident. It was really nice. He's good lecturer and advisor.
Yeah. There's one thing that concerns me a little, or that you may have an issue with, and that's FDA approval. Because you're moseying into the coming very close to medical device here.
Right. And that's also the bold claim that we make, that we actually are on the medical grade, but of course it needs certificates. And for that sense, I mean, it is an open source project, but for that sense, we also founded a company, so like we can at least provide the service to get certificates. And
You would think of trying to get it FDA approved?
Yes. So I mean, in the beginning, of course, right now it's more focused on for the hacker scene. It's for the hacker scene, and so like of course, and then so like maybe it could be a stretched goal, but for now it's just. We showed that we will bring this device and you can do things at home, but of course we don't make the medical claim officially.
And you shouldn't do either, because you get sued for that. You need to come up with a new word. Can you tell me a bit background of the project, the licensing, who's involved, who's funding it, that sort of thing?
Right now actually we are four people. That is me, so I'm like a computer scientist, and I've also done research in neuroscientific field, dealing with EEG classification. Then we have Robert. He's right now doing the processing, talking to the manufacturers, and we're trying to get also like European funding a little bit to just to because right now we're living out of the own pockets the whole time. Masahiro, like he's really the essential hardware part, because like this is all the research, all the development he's been doing for 30 years now. So he keeps testing also new amplifier setup, and then there's also Silver right there. Then he's helping Masahiro also with the hardware, and also we want to make connect the hardware with the software the best it can get actually.
The software. And is the hardware open source?
Yes. So sorry about the licensing. So it's the Brainduino. This is all open source, and right now it's the MIT license.
Yeah.
But maybe we're not sure. Maybe we're going to do GPL, but we haven't decided yet. But like for now, it's MIT. So you can download the schematics, and So for the software right now, I still have to do some cleanup, but I will soon put this on the GitHub also. So it's going to be also open source. And it's going to be
whatever the open license is.
I didn't decide yet what could be the best for.
But it's going to be a free software license.
Yes, okay. That's my. Yeah.
That was the answer I was looking for. Okay. anything else that I missed or?
We're looking for call for participation because it's an open source project, and we still need like people who want to do like game development or you know like neuro gaming, like the gamification of training your brainwaves. Yeah. So we need still content. Like this is really some things we miss, and so we're really looking for hackers or designers, people who would like to make some content. And
I think there's a lot of different aspects with it, because you got the hardware, you got the fashion side to it, you've got the real hardcore electronics, and you've got the software program, plus you got the medical aspect. So yeah. I'm sure there's something for everybody on this project.
Yeah, really, it's so much work to do. So that's where we reach out to people. That's why we came to FOSDEM, and because we think it's already a great tool, but of course, yeah. There's work to be done, yeah.
Do you know how much it's going to cost, or do we have any ideas?
Yeah, so right now... if you order the parts right now, it's something like maybe $150. But if you make it assembled and everything, we hope to... Yeah, of course, with casing and everything, maybe it's going to be something around $200, a little bit more. But which is fair. Also, compared to the few consumer devices out there right now...
Believe me, if you've worked in the medical field, this is peanuts.
Yeah. Yeah. Of course. Maybe the medical certificate is a whole different thing, but right now we focus on making just a hacker product. Yeah.
Okay, cool. Thank you very much, and enjoy the rest of the show. I'm standing in front of the Butter Knife project, and I'm talking to...
Hi, I'm Lauri, and we're hosting a butter knife booth here at FOSDEM. And basically, I've been working for the past year or even more on the migration project in Tallinn. So Tallinn is the capital of Estonia, and the Tallinn Education Board decided to try out Linux on the school computers. And the 4,000 computers that we shipped in September, they are now dual boot. So there's Windows and Ubuntu 14.4 installed on them.
Okay.
And my task was to prepare a Ubuntu image for those machines. And as part of the whole migration project, I developed this tool called Butterknife. You can check it out at butterknife.rocks. So it's the website.
Butterknife.rocks.
Exactly.
Awesome.
So these are these new hipster top-level domains. And what basically we're doing is that I'm preparing the template of the operating system on a server inside the Linux container. And then I basically use Butterknife snapshots capability to take a snapshot of the container. And after that, it becomes available on the network using the Butterknife server. On the target machines, I boot up the Butterknife provisioning image. And the provisioning image basically downloads the template on the target computer and, of course, sets up a partition table, file systems, etc., and then downloads this ButterFS snapshot there. Afterwards, the bootloader is set up, and within 15 minutes, your computer is basically ready to be used. And as a cherry on the top, we also provide multicasting capability. So the basic idea of the Butterknife was that... couldn't make any assumptions about the local infrastructure. So as a fallback, you can basically use a memory stick to boot up 30 computers. You can use a single memory stick to do that. And you can have one computer which is downloading the snapshot from the server and broadcasting it onto the local network segment using multicast.
I personally am a big fan of multicast. It's awesome. But can you explain to people what multicast is just as a...
So multicast basically avoids the overhead of downloading the snapshot into each individual computer. And by using multicast, the same packet is essentially transferred to all of those computers in a classroom. So essentially, you could deploy, let's say, 10 gigabyte image on a gigabit LAN within like 2 minutes. It's ultra fast.
Yeah, excellent. So it's also a way for just provisioning, mass provisioning of systems. So universities or companies that have got new machines in, they can just blast the desktops.
Exactly. So it's mainly targeted for desktops. For servers, you already have a bunch of different tools that can achieve that. But for desktops, I couldn't find anything that would make my life significantly easier. We also provide scripts to join the machine into Active Directory domain. So after deployment, you don't even have to create any local user accounts. Just in the menu, select join domain, enter the credentials, and boom, it's joined to a domain. And of course, if you have Puppet infrastructure in place, you can use that. I have the template is connected to the Puppet server, so it's regularly updated. And after the deployment, the machines also pop up in the Puppet master, so I can continue managing them from there.
And this was developed entirely by yourself?
It's actually a really tiny project.
It looks awesome.
That's the beauty of it. It's like simple ideas put together that help you to cut down the deployment time significantly.
Quite a lot of our guys work in the education sector, so this is probably on the edge of their seat.
And that's actually where I'd like to ask that. If you have a big computer park somewhere, next number I'm targeting would be, well, 40,000. If you have a big computer park, just send me an email and maybe we can have some kind of business agreement, and we could cooperate and do something together.
Excellent stuff. Anything else coming up this year that I need to know about?
The cool feature that we will be adding to the Butterknife is a online incremental upgrade feature. So basically, you have the computer running. The new snapshot will be downloaded in the background, and we are doing incremental upgrade, which means like if you have this image is like 10 gigabytes, we will only download the differences, apply it to the file system, rearrange the bootloader, and then the icon pops up, says, your software has been updated, please reboot into the new snapshot.
And what happens to user files, or are those all stored on the network?
Exactly, a good question. So for the home folder is in a separate subvolume, which is persistent. And same goes for the Samba and Kerberos credentials. They are stored in a persistent subvolume. Everything else gets wiped out. And if you have user accounts in an Active Directory compatible domain, that could be also Samba domain, then you don't have to worry about user accounts. So everything will stay as it is. You can even like migrate from 32 to 64 bits and do all sorts of funky stuff that otherwise would not be possible.
Excellent stuff. Just before I go, I'll have you enter in some details of the project onto for the show notes, and so people can contact you there. Thank you very much. And I'm talking to
Elizabeth Flanagan.
Hi, Elizabeth. What are you here showing off?
I am showing off a semi-working hurdy-gurdy, or a Villeroux, or there's a few different names for it. It's an 11th century music instrument, but this is a modern-day takeoff of that.
So can you describe what a traditional one would be? There's a wheel or a crank at one end, and then...
So a traditional hurdy-gurdy is essentially a continuously bowed keyed violin. It has a wooden wheel that is cranked. There is rosin on the wheel. The wheel touches a set of strings. There's melody strings, drone strings, and a set of strings called trumpets, which can be used to create a tempo. And the melody strings go through a key box and are fretted with these things called tangents that basically push up against the string to shorten the string length. It works substantially differently.
Which brings us to why you're a FOSDEM, I guess.
Yes, it brings us... So this has a Minoboard Max in it. It is...
Well, for a start, let me describe what this is. It's like shaped like a little boat, about the size of your arm. It's got the traditional crank at the end, and then it's all transparent plastic and really nice designs at the top. So, from there.
Sure. On the crank end, we have a DC permanent magnet motor that is a crank is connected to the output shaft. So when you crank a DC motor, what happens? It produces electricity. this can produce, as far as I can tell by cranking it as fast as I can go, something around 42 volts. It runs into a voltage divider and a protection diode that drops that down to about 5 volts.
That's this device here?
Well, no. That is right here.
Right on
the back of the motor.
Right on the back of the motor, yeah.
And that goes into an analog input, and that essentially controls the volume. So when you think about how you play a violin, if you bow very lightly, very slowly, you have a very low volume to it. If you bow very quick, it's a lot more...
I would have thought it's yeah, okay.
Yeah, it's a lot louder. So then what this brings us to is the key box here, which...
She's lifting up the cover.
24 keys. There are about 24 keys here, and instead of having 24 separate inputs, there is a... two flexible resistors that basically the backs of the keys bang up into and change the resistance of this, and this goes into one analog input.
Okay, hold on, because I need to describe this. So we're looking at essentially a plastic box. And when you're talking about keys, you're talking about musical instrument keys that would slide in and out. So think of like the letter T, and you push that in, and it's got pins that go in and out on the inside, and there are metal screws on that.
Yep. And the screws are just there to keep these from falling out.
Where does it generate the resistance then if it's a plastic component?
These on the back end, if you can see right back here, are two flexible resistors.
Ah, I see them at the back.
And those end up getting muxed together, creating resistance. And depending on which key you press, depends on what the resistance is.
So the key goes back onto these little metal strips at the back, and then the resistance changes.
Yes.
But can you play two of them at the same time? Will that double the resistance? Or?
No, they won't, because the way I have them wired up, it basically acts as one big resistor. So it basically knows where in the resistor thing it is.
So if you play this key, pick two or nothing, are they...
It always plays the lower key. So it always plays the key with the lowest resistance. Yes, you can press two keys because it will recognize that, okay, two keys are hitting like on one end or on the other end. Like folks use these for position detection and et cetera. But because it's a stringed instrument, think about a guitar. I can fret the same string twice, but it only picks the lower fret.
Yes, of course.
Of course.
Thank
right.
you. Duh. Okay.
So the way
thank you for walking me through
this.
I'm not the sharpest tool.
No, that's fine.
Okay, cool.
So essentially, that's what's going on here. Now we're still in the process of getting some stuff working on this. So for example,
we got the resistance. Where does that go though?
This goes right into an analog input right here.
On a what?
On the board. Yes.
On what's the board?
The board is a Minoboard Max with a Calamari Lore.
There we go.
And it runs a distribution that I work for. I work for Intel, and I work full-time on the Yocto project and Open Embedded. I'm the release engineer for Open Embedded and Yocto project.
And a frustrated musician and an artist at the same time.
A frustrated musician, maintainer of the Yocto Auto Builder. And like the reason this all came about is I used to play an instrument called a bowed dulcimer. Which is an Appalachian Mountain dulcimer. It's like, think of a mini cello. And my other hobby is motorcycles. Those don't necessarily always match up, and I got in a really serious motorcycle accident and broke my hand. So I can no longer hold a bow right.
Well, that sucks.
Well, but I can crank.
Yes.
I can crank. So when I started looking around at like what instruments I can play, I realized, okay, here's an instrument that I can play with a broken hand. And I started calling around, and all the luthiers that I was talking to, they were telling me 4 to 6 months for a dulcimer or for a hurdy-gurdy. And I was like, that's great. I'm not waiting that long. So I said, okay, you guys do this, and I'm going to work on this, and we'll see which one gets done first. And then I got busy, and 5 months later, I hadn't started this yet. And I said, I better start this. So I started it. Got it ready. I presented this at Embedded Linux Conference in Dublin this year. And literally, like 3 days later, my other hurdy-gurdy came in. So I beat a luthier, but not by much.
And can you play both, either?
No, poorly.
Poorly, yeah.
Very, very poorly.
Well, it is, I must say, very beautiful to look at. But then again, I'm an engineer. No, I think it is a work of art. It works on so many levels. It's absolutely awesome. Photos of this will be in the show notes. How did you do the physical manufacturing of it?
So I sat there with Inkscape, and I said, I know what I want this to look like. There was some online site that does...
I think you got distracted with the top case for sure.
No, actually, that was easy. There was a...
I'm pointing out a very elaborately, beautifully designed... floral motif with flowers, or with a little bird and some flowers.
There was a on Google Images, someone had a design that was open, and I just borrowed that and stretched it out to fit on that. Yeah, and threw it into Inkscape. The major problem was I initially designed this when I was living in the States for quarter millimeter. Or quarter inch. Yeah, do you see the problem there? quarter inch plexiglass. But the quarter inch acrylic. But the thing is that quarter inch and 6 millimeter are close enough that they kind of overlap. So you can use 6 mil or quarter inch and works fine.
Yes, you just increase your tolerances.
Yeah.
That was obvious by design. Excellent.
So yeah, it was a design flaw that worked in my favor.
Okay, thank you very much. We're at the Core Boot, Flash ROM booth, and we're talking to?
I'm Carl Daniel Heilfinger. I'm, doing a bit of community outreach right now.
Yes, quite a lot actually today. It's very hard to get hold of you. We spoke to you in detail last year. We did an excellent interview, so there'll be a link to that interview here. Very quickly, what is Core Boot? What is Flash ROM elevator pitch?
Okay, the management elevator pitch is that Core Boot is a replacement for your BIOS and EFI. It's a free firmware found on x86, ARM, MIPS, and others. It's shipped by default on every Chromebook out there. So if you have a Chromebook laptop, you're using Core Boot.
Excellent.
And Flash ROM is essentially just a tool to write the firmware you want to the flash chip you want. So, for example, if you want to update your BIOS, you can do so under pretty much any operating system with Flash ROM. You can also use Flash ROM to reflash something externally, use all the various flashing hardware. You can even abuse a Raspberry Pi for that. So you can even recover bricked laptops with the help of a Raspberry Pi and Flash ROM.
This is a new thing this year, is it?
we could always, we can do this since a few years, but we never advertised it really. So
how does that work exactly?
The Raspberry Pi has an SPI bus present, and Flash ROM can address that SPI bus and just talk to the flash chip over the SPI bus. Just connect the write pins of your Raspberry Pi to the flash chip of the target device, which has a bricked BIOS update or whatever, can read out the old contents, write the new contents. It's all over in a few minutes.
Oh, there are people out there listening to this going, thank you, thank you. Okay, you have a list. Talk to me.
So, yeah, you wanted to know about the cool stuff Core Boot has done in the past year, and
yeah.
I'm afraid the list is a bit too long to actually list it. So what we did is we got quite a lot of new processors and chipsets supported on x86 and on ARM. And on ARM, a few new vendors have showed up. For example, Rockchip and NVIDIA have showed up. And as far as I know, they wrote the Core Boot support themselves for them.
NVIDIA?
Yes. And I see you're looking at me wondering if I'm still rug-free. But yeah, the biggest point is that vendors noticed that if they use Core Boot on their hardware, And then they can combine core boot with a Linux kernel, and they don't have to write all the drivers twice, as usually they would do with other firmware. So usually they would implement a driver for their hardware in Linux kernel, and then re-implement the driver for the firmware they care about. And given that core boot doesn't need all those drivers, and can reuse a few MTD drivers if you need that for NAND flash access, you can just run core boot directly and have it execute a Linux kernel, and that saves vendors a lot of trouble and effort porting and supporting their hardware. Some vendors claimed it reduced the amount of work they have to spend on a new platform in half, and that's a real benefit. And the other benefit, which also the ARM vendors are claiming, is that their old firmware support packages they created, they needed to support that themselves. Now, core boot has some pretty good documentation. So if a large processor vendor wants to sell small designs, they don't have to support users with like prototypes of prototype runs of 100 devices themselves. They just can say, oh, well, the source code is there, do what you want. And if they get a design win and the production scales, they don't need to support those people again, so it's a win-win for them. Yeah, and so they are really happy about that. And then there's also some additional chipset or processor architectures supported. We are now moving in the MIPS direction. Yes, and also the experimental CPU architecture RISC-V, which is essentially a free instruction set architecture. We do have core boot support for that as well, even if there's not that much real hardware out there, and most of it is implemented in FPGAs. Still, it exists, and it's going forward. Then, from a more general user perspective, we have lots more ThinkPads supported. We have a few MacBooks supported nowadays. So people who always say, well, ThinkPads are ugly, we love MacBooks. Well, now those people can be made happy as well.
So you can turn a MacBook into a free, 100% free device.
Yes, of course.
Oh, the irony of that.
Well, yeah, especially considering that this is not really something you expect from a MacBook.
Yeah, yes, exactly.
And then there's also lots of more Chromebooks which were released, and given that all Chromebooks run core boot, it's a natural design win. Then from a not a directly board support point of view, we have a better code structure. We reorganized some of the code. And now we have an infrastructure to test every commit in our repository with all the hardware we support. So we have now an open source testing software where you can hook up targets to a Raspberry Pi. And they will test each new commit and will publish reports whether something failed, so we know immediately if something breaks.
And who it was.
And that's actually very much needed, because usually people say, hey, core boot runs on a machine, that's great, no need to ever reflash it, because it works. And people then just don't track whether it still works in newer versions. That continuous testing infrastructure really helps us a lot to ensure continued trust in actually running code.
Is that on physical hardware, or is it all
physical hardware? Well, we also test every proposed patch on virtual hardware, but on physical hardware, just we don't have enough machines right now in the labs, in the various labs. Where
before it goes live, then it's...
Yeah. Well, the notifications after the fact to not hold up the commits, but still, I think it's pretty valuable. So at most, you have a delay of something like 2 hours after a commit where the failure or success reports show up. So that's pretty okay. Also, we are now doing more community gatherings. We had an official core boot conference in October 2015. The great thing was that quite a few vendors showed up as well. And we will have some more core boot developer meetings and conferences. One of them is scheduled for Embedded Linux Conference Europe in Berlin in fall 2016. we have something which we have.
But just, you were saying that at that event there will be a table where you can bring your laptop and they will.
Yes. Well, we have to differentiate. We try to have some sort of time couple between the Corbett conference in fall and the Embedded Linux conference, so people don't have to travel across the pond twice.
Yep.
And we are also present now at pretty much every hacker event or hacker conference or software conference. We're here at FOSDEM offering people to reflash their laptops with Corbett. With success guarantee. We were present at KS Communication Congress, KS Communication Camp, pretty much every conference in Europe which has something to do with hacking or with software, we are present. We have started user groups, Corbett user groups, to support people. Quite a few hackerspaces offer reflashing services. So
yeah. I was going to bring my completely dead laptop, but I thought, no, I'm not going to bug you when you're doing FOSDEM.
If the laptop is supported by Corbett, you can just bring your laptop and ask us, can I leave the laptop here? I'll return an hour later, and you have a laptop with Corbett.
Excellent stuff.
That's our sort of, that's our way also of improving community outreach, because some people are just too afraid to attempt that for themselves. And we have the experience to reflash that stuff, and we know what to do when something goes wrong. So we can guarantee you that you will leave without a brick, but rather with either the original factory BIOS restored if you dislike Corbett for some reason, or a working Corbett installation on your hardware.
Excellent.
And there is some more thing. We have the first Android device running Corbett.
Excellent.
The Google Chromebook Pixel C. And the firmware was written by the Chromebook firmware team, which means they also have upstream pretty much all of their kernel changes. So you can run the recent Linux kernel upstream with it, and you have Corbett below. So that's also something we're really happy and we would like the industry moving. Then there's also something from a security perspective. We have reproducible builds now, so regardless on which platform you rebuild a Corbett image, even if you do it under Windows, the result will be binary identical to the build somebody else did on something completely different machine. So you can really verify that the source code matches the binary which is generated at the end.
So you can check the SHA keys or the
signatures. We not really check the signatures, we just rebuild from the sources, and if the result is completely identical, we know it wasn't tampered with. So that's easier than doing all the signature checking. We also have something which is interesting for people who don't have time to follow the mailing list. We have regular blog posts, which are essentially this week in Corbett, all the interesting developments of the past week or the past month. Also, this is more outreach, and yeah. That is pretty much... and we got to release more versions. We had Corbett version 4.0 since pretty much a long time, and now we had version 4.1, 4.2, and we are doing regular releases, and with all the quality assurance we are now doing. I think Corbett is in a quite better state than 1 year ago. It wasn't bad back then, but... I'm now really, really happy.
Yeah, you can tell actually by the amount of buzz at the hall and how difficult it has been for me to get hold of you for the last 2 days.
Yeah,
so finally, we're nearly at the end of FOSDEM. Okay, cool.
The other thing, given that Corbett and FlashROM are really linked in the sense that you need FlashROM to put Corbett to the hardware, the FlashROM project has a bit slower on development. Is a bit slower on development, but there's not that much to do anymore because FlashROM in itself works. We are have a sprint to merge some new features, and we're doing some more infrastructure work. When we are also working on automated testing for FlashROM, because with FlashROM, everybody cares about reliability, like with Corbett. People do not care if you are 5 seconds faster, but they care very much that what ends up in the firmware image, in the firmware flash, is exactly the stuff you wanted to have there. And we are currently building a testing rig for Flashroom, which would do the same as what the CoreBoot testing rig does. So not that much news on the Flashroom front, but it's also coming along nicely, and people are generally happy that it's still very reliable.
Excellent stuff. Thank you very much for the update, and keep up the good work.
Thank you very much, and I would be happy to welcome people wanting their laptops flashed at the next conference. It's just in fire whether we are there.
Can I, on our website, will there be lists of that? Is that something that people can
expect? We have, on our website, we have a list of, we have a list of upcoming conferences where we are present, and usually presence at a conference means we also offer reflashing services.
So, okay, so don't be embarrassed to bring your laptop and get it flashed.
Probably it would be a good idea to tell us in advance how many of you are planning to come, because we can't be there with like 50 people reflashing 500 laptops at the same time. But that's a service which we officially offer.
One more point?
Yeah. We also are now trying to improve community organization, and we are trying to start a non-profit here in Europe.
Oh yeah.
So people can actually then donate to the CoreBoot project that was impossible in the past, and we're trying to have this non-profit also as a sort of point of contact if somebody wants to have us as a conference or something like that.
Oh, very good. Yeah, okay. Good idea. Anything else?
No, that is
it. Okay.
Thank you.
No problem. Hi, this is Ken. I'm at the Open Embedded Project, and I'm talking to
Florian Bohr from Open Embedded Project. And we are making a build system for building various software for different devices. So we are showing different devices running the same software stack here, and one of the devices is based on an ARM CPU, one is based on x86 CPU, and we have the same software made from the same software descriptions, which are part of Open Embedded. Major share of Open Embedded...
the exact same code.
Sorry?
The exact same code. You're running the exact same code on...
It's the same code, but it is built for different machine architectures.
Yeah.
And this is something Open Embedded solves for you. Open Embedded mostly contains a lot of descriptions where to find software, how to configure it, how to cross-compile it, how to package it in an efficient way. And this is used to build complete firmware images for all sorts of target devices. And in this way, since we build everything from source, you can have the same software stack running on different machines. Of course, on top of the generic software descriptions, you have some to adapt or to make your own hardware descriptions, maybe add some board support like customized Linux kernels or bootloaders. Everything from the software description till the finished firmware image is solved by Open Embedded, and it's done mostly automatically.
Okay, very good. You have some demonstrations here on the table. I think they're from other projects, but I wonder, could you bring me through them?
Yes, we have. The one demo we have is showing a software-defined radio device. We have one based off a quite generic Intel x86 hardware, and it's a motherboard running a software image with a software-defined radio dongle attached to USB and running a graphical user interface for controlling this software-defined radio receiver dongle. And the second part of the demo is a commercial software-defined radio device running the same software with the same user interface, but on this completely different software platform. So, another strong thing we are currently showing is a demo of Toaster, which is kind of web front end for Open Embedded, which is used for configuring, scheduling, and controlling software builds. Software builds are quite time consuming and hard to control thing because compiling millions of lines of codes, there's a lot of things that can go wrong, and the front end assists you controlling this build process, monitoring what is actually going on, and showing in and checking the actual results, checking reports of quality assurance tools, checking the results of size check, because you many devices you have a quite restricted amount of storage space for your file systems and things like this.
And what's that program called?
It's Toaster.
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 And that's part of where can I find out information about that?
It's developed under the umbrella of the Yocto project, and you can find information. Well, the easiest way to find information is to take a look at the Yocto project website.
So, how would you recommend people get involved in the various different projects?
That's pretty easy. That's one of the really nice things at Open Embedded is you don't even have to be a developer to get involved with this project. Major share of the work in Open Embedded is getting descriptions for software for the builds done, and these are made in a pretty easy human and machine readable form, and so almost everyone who's able to at least use a compiler or a build tool like AutoTools is able to get involved into the project and get and to contribute additional stuff. And we have a website. We have lots of documentation and information how to get started with a project in general. So the target audience is all sorts of mostly Linux running embedded devices or mobile devices, and so the target audience for the devices is the share of people could be interested in working with Open Embedded, doing custom software images, building custom software for the devices is pretty high.
Okay, very good. Hi everybody, this is Ken. We're at Pico TCP and we're talking to...
Toon Peters. I'm from Intelligent Systems, Altran, and standing here with Pico CP on Fosdem yet again for another edition.
Now, we spoke last year, or I spoke to the project. Can you tell us what Pico TCP is in very, very short?
In very short?
Well, take as long as you like, actually. It's Hacker Public Radio. You can be 4 hours.
Awesome.
I don't really care.
That's also short. Oh, okay. So Pico TCP is really a TCP IP stack for the small embedded devices.
Yep.
You have Pico TCP in Linux.
Yep.
We want to put Pico TCP in everything. Yep. Also the places where Linux doesn't fit.
Yeah.
And it should allow you to create devices that you can easily attach to the Internet of Things and get going.
And so like what we're talking about here is the full TCP IP stack.
So
IPv6 as well, I'm imagining. Yeah.
Even IPv6, yeah. If we implement something, we go all the way.
Yeah.
So that's full RFC compliance, and that means also fully RFC tested.
Yeah.
So we do our own tests on that side. So IPv6 is one thing, and sometimes there are some even more exotic ones. Now we're working on 6LoWPAN 2, so really going towards the Internet of Things.
Yeah.
And that's, then you need good IPv6 implementation for sure.
Yeah, yeah.
But yeah, for those who are just looking for IPv4, we have all the standard stuff, the TCP, the UDP, everything you want. DHCP, who needs dynamic IPs?
No, it'll be fine. I guess the reason you need this are the devices are smaller memory footprint.
Yeah.
You've got different architectures that you're going to have to support as well.
Yeah, and we already do support quite a lot of them.
Yeah.
So we have a nice overview on that little list over there. And the audience cannot see that, but we really start all the way at the bottom with 8-bit devices.
Yep.
And one of our guys was
8-bit devices.
8-bit devices. Yep. One of our guys was feeling adventurous, and he tried to port it to an Atmega 128.
Okay, that's hard.
So flash size, okay, but as soon as you start doing TCP, you need a lot of RAM too, and that's where the bottleneck is with these devices.
Okay.
So you just had to add an external memory device he could use as RAM, because otherwise it didn't work. But it fits, it works. Then 16-bitters, it's part of the market is also in there. You know, the microchip, the TIs, all of those. And then the 32 bits, and those are the most popular for us to develop on.
Yeah.
Also, certain customers coming to us mainly with 32-bit ARM microcontrollers. But then we go even further. So, mainly our development is done in Linux itself.
Yeah.
We're using ton and top devices to just connect it to your regular networking environment in Linux.
That's a tunnel and.
Ton is on layer 2 and top is on layer 1.
Okay, gotcha.
Then you also have VDE where you can do crazy stuff with switches and everything.
Okay, you're going to lose me now.
But that's a lot of fun.
Steer me back.
Okay, back to where we came from, the platforms. So Linux, we develop on that too, which means actually that we also work on the 64-bit devices, and yeah, we can just keep on going.
And would you need a Linux stack in order to run this, or will it runs a standalone?
I think that was a project that was done this year. Is to like, okay, how far can we go? So you take the standard Linux kernel, which contains a TCP/IP stack. You cut off the TCP/IP stack, and you put PicoTCP in place. And what does that give you is that actually your standard Linux kernel becomes a lot smaller. And the TCP/IP stack is a significant part of this size in the Linux stack. So by using PicoTCP instead of the standard stack in the Linux kernel, you could actually even put Linux on smaller devices than be possible by default.
If you can run PicoTCP in Linux, why not just run PicoTCP in like Debian on your regular server?
Let's say that's a fun project, but there is not really a need. If you have it on your regular server, saving like 100K or 200K, if you have a couple of terabytes of storage, people don't really care. So it could be a fun project, but on the other hand, we're targeting the small devices.
Gotcha. How did you just end up? Like, did you wake up one day as a kid going, God, I really need to get into TCP/IP on a low level?
It was one of our colleagues, actually one of the organizers here at FOSDEM, who was at a customer, and he really felt the need a bit for, like, there is something lacking in this market. So either you have a full stack that contains everything but is like one solid block and you take it or you leave it, or you are left in the dark with maybe some commercial stacks that you'd have no idea about what they offer. So we were looking for, or we found that little gap where we thought, we need something modular that we can easily port, that everybody can start to use. And that's where he then just started with the project.
Okay, on your spiel thing going across here, I see open source and proprietary. What does that mean? Is it like open core, or is it the same code base?
Well,
and what's the license, by the way?
The license is GPLv2.
Okay.
It's always a tough choice to choose a license, but that's what we went for, and so far we're still happy with it. This means that the entire PicoTCP core with all the modules is totally open source, released under that.
What do I get if I go for the proprietary option?
You can compile your stuff. So we have a getting started guide.
Yeah.
You can do all of that with what is publicly available, which means you can compile your setup. You can start running ping, TCP, DHCP, everything you want.
Yeah.
And on top of that, we have a separate repository with code that is we don't feel quite comfortable yet to put it entirely in the code base. And there you'll find DHCP, MQTT integrations with other ones. Also those ones we release under GPLv2. So you can pretty much get everything out on the internet.
So why would I, okay, aside from supporting the project and doing the right thing, is there anything in the proprietary license that isn't in there?
The proprietary license allows people who are not compatible with GPLv2 to actually use our stack.
Okay, get it. Okay, good answer, Batman. Well done. So anything else here that you want to show me or that I missed?
You feel like playing Snake?
Probably not going to work for... Oh, look, I'm winning. I've just won.
Yes. No, yeah. You're not. No, I am. Anyway, it's one of the things we've been working on this year also.
What does that got to do with Pico TCP?
Well, actually, with the controllers, we've turned into Pico TCP nodes. So they're now network-enabled controllers, and you can be sitting in another room and still
or
play Pico TCP.
Side of the world.
Yeah, then a webcam could be useful, but...
Might be a smidgen overkill, but...
Yeah. So this is actually the end result of a workshop that we've been giving around Pico TCP. We've been doing this mainly internally for a couple of times, also towards students who are very interested in working with it. And we would like to spread this workshop even further into the world and see who else is interested. So
I have the sinking suspicion Beer was involved in this workflow somewhere.
We'd like to call them pizza and beer sessions at times. So yeah, of course, Beer was involved. But it's really a lot of fun what comes out of these.
And what's that? Have you had to add anything to the controllers to get them to work?
Well, Pico TCP.
Other than that, is you.
There is not much.
I mean, have you had to make any hardware modifications to get them to work?
No, these are. We love our friends at Seed Studio. That's a Chinese company. And they make great hardware, and it's really cool that these boards are like entirely containing. Everything is on there, so you have the full Ethernet hardware available on top of your ARM Cortex M something. I don't know which number exactly. Well, we have an LPC inside. So it's a really neat development platform. We would love to see them even cheaper so we can really hand them out.
How much are they?
These are 40 or 50 euros still.
Still?
Yeah.
I mean, now we think, you know, with the Pi, you're thinking, oh, God, that's really expensive now.
Yes.
Whereas, like, 2 years ago, it was, oh, it's under 200 euros. Wow, that's good.
Or certain Wi-Fi platforms that you can buy these little boards for, like, 2 euros or something.
Yeah.
But Wi-Fi is always a bit more difficult to develop on, so we like to have wired. It costs a bit more, but...
Yeah.
Then we can really do everything.
Exactly. Anything else cool that you want to show? What's the light? Go on.
The light? Well, there's some instructions.
There's a connect.
There's
and
actually a Wi-Fi
light.
Chip inside running Pico TCP. This is actually the chip I was talking
this
about.
This looks like a regular old thing that you get at the Gamma or
So it's
okay. It's an external
I'll hit
light.
It inside.
Oh yeah, and at the case. Hold on, I got to take a photo of this.
This is plastic. So
it's a regular old outside light, LED type thing, I guess. Put my finger in there. I'll try and get the
so
light in.
A bit of hardware modifications allows it to control it via Wi-Fi. So you can log in and then you get a web UI and you can change the colors and everything.
Shiny.
Yeah, that always works. LEDs, we love them.
Excellent. So
this is one of the tiny Wi-Fi devices. Here we're bumping into some problems with licensing because it's actually an Espersif ESP8266 device. That's incredibly cheap. So 1.5 euros or a bit bigger development board, 4 euros, you have it. But their proprietary binary for doing all the wireless stuff, that's closed source. Which means Pico TCP is in fact not compatible with it, or they are not compatible with us. Let's call it like that. We're on FOSDEM. Which means we cannot release this code.
That sucks.
That's really annoying because it's super cool. We've been trying to talk to these guys, see if there is a way out, but
I suppose if some of our community members just started emailing these guys and asking,
well, Maybe.
The Pico TCP guys would like it. I'd love to order 4 million of these things. Can you please?
We already have a couple of guys who have been asking for this, but yeah. We always have to disappoint them.
So is there anything else coming up this year that I need to know about?
I think we're really going to focus more on community building. We feel this product or this stack is really mature.
Yeah.
We have the quality. We can assure that everything stays green. That's what we will do internally.
Yeah.
What we now are looking for is people who want to integrate Pico TCP in their own product, who want to do products with it, who want to develop some crazy protocol that can go somewhere in between one of the layers or on top of.
Why reinvent the wheel?
Sorry?
Why reinvent the wheel if you can take your code?
Yeah. So... Cool. We want people to use it.
Excellent stuff. Thank you very much for taking the time, and enjoy the rest of the show.
Thanks.
The project is called?
PTXDIST.
And you are?
Alexander Ahring.
And what is PTXDIST?
Yeah, that's a build system tool which helps you to cross-compile all necessary stuff for your specialized platform like the Raspberry Pi. So if you want to make a Linux system, you need to care about the bootloader, the root file system, and user-space software, and finally also the Linux kernel. And PTXDIST sets all environment variables and for cross-compiling all necessary stuff. And finally, it plops out a file system image, and you can flash it on your SD card and then put it in your Raspberry Pi, and finally Linux will boot and everything should work. But you can also add more software interfacing for auto tools, so you can easily add your own custom software to a PTXDIST board support package. And then it finally adds your software to the final image root file system.
So on the HPR network, there's people and they're writing their own software for operating system for the Raspberry Pi. So this will be a way of speeding up the compilation process to get it over to the Pi, I guess. But so when you're doing the compilation, you're using something like Ubuntu or Fedora or something like that.
Yeah.
And then you cross-compile over to the Pi.
Yes, exactly.
Is there any hardware involved or not? Do you need any special hardware, or do you put the SD card into your own PC?
We have some FreeBSD board support package, which is open source. And there is also a platform for QEMU. And this QEMU platform, you can run QEMU on it, and it will... boots your PTXDIST image. You don't need special hardware for testing, but then you can switch maybe to Raspberry Pi, and then your software runs also on the Raspberry Pi.
Okay, so what do I need to do to get PTXDIST installed? Is that a Linux distro in itself, or... is that an application I download from?
It's an application. You can download it on pdxdist.org and install it on your Linux machine.
Yeah.
And then you need the FreeBSD. We name it DistroKit. And it supports several platforms, the BeagleBone, the Raspberry Pi 1, the Raspberry Pi 2, and finally the QEMU.
What is that piece of software? Is that software or hardware?
What?
You have the PTXDIST, then you have something else. What's the something else?
That's the board support package, but this requires PTXDIST, which has all the rules, the receipts for cross-compiling the necessary software, and this is required to build your board support package for your platform.
Okay, and then at the end of the day, there's a software file on my laptop, which I put on a USB stick or USB stick.
Yeah, or SD card flash with this DD, like common on other Yes.
Why would somebody make their own distribution for the Raspberry Pi? Says he.
I mean, it's an embedded system, and you have finally one use case maybe for it, to run maybe a VPN daemon or something else. And then with PDXs you can do your special use case running for your Raspberry Pi.
And is it only Raspberry Pi, or are there any other devices?
We support in the board support package the Raspberry Pi 2 also,
yeah.
And the BeagleBone.
Okay, and
BeagleBone, yeah. And finally the QEMU with doesn't where you don't need any hardware.
Okay, and have you got your hands on the Raspberry Pi 1 yet or not? Or the Zero?
The Zero. No, but I know the CPU is the same like the one,
yeah.
And it should work.
Yeah. Very good. Why did you start this project?
My company, Pangotronics, starts the project, and because customers wants to run Linux and makes then for their final embedded use case to optimize, and it's on an open source project. Everybody can join, and all other companies are also can look into the code.
What sort of a license is it released under?
It's one moment. It's under GPL v2.
Okay, and something else.
We also have some bootloader Bearbox.
Yeah, what is that?
Bearbox is an incredible fancy bootloader.
Yeah.
Because it looks like Linux if you run it, but have not many process management or something else. It has also internally the device interface like the Linux kernel, so introducing new devices in mostly copy-pasting the Linux drivers and into the Bearbox system.
So it's like is it a cut-down grub or a replacement for grub? Or, you don't have grub, but the bootloader itself?
Is it
an operating system in itself, or is it just to load another operating system?
Yeah, that's a difficult question because some people want to make an operation system with that.
Yeah.
But currently it's only a bootloader.
Yeah.
But it has not interrupt handling yet. So also copy-pasting Linux drivers, you need to care about the IRQ handling.
Yeah.
Do some pussy waiting mechanism instead of request IRQ. And such stuff, and it also has a file system layer, and you can over Ethernet connect your network file system NFS and inside the bootloader. And
how big is that? What size file size does it get to? What sort of resources would you need to be running?
It depends what you enable. It also use kconfig, like the Linux kernel.
Yeah.
You can enable and disable much stuff of them. Like,
so is it Linux or is it not Linux? Is it derived from Linux?
It's the same license,
yeah.
Which need to be. I think you need to make your own experience.
Do you take the Linux kernel and then strip it out, or is this a separate project that uses bits from the Linux kernel?
It was based on U-boot,
yeah.
But then we grabbed some Linux headers,
yeah.
To have the identical interfaces for the drivers, and and that's why it looks like the feeling and of Linux.
Okay, cool. What sort of devices have you here on the table? What are you demoing?
My demo is more about 6LoWPAN. This is for IPv6 over low power wireless personal area networks.
Okay.
That's something like Bluetooth low energy.
Yeah.
And there exists another low power wireless standard like which is named 802.15.4. It's not common.
It's a catchy name.
Catching name. What you want is a IPv6 on connection on such networks to connect them into the Internet of Things. So you can put some transceiver at your light bulb or heater for enable and disable your light, or temperature sensoring of your heater, and over the Bluetooth connection, which is low power, and then you need only to replace the battery for around 3 years.
Okay, so that I'll take some photos of that in the show notes. And what's the device on the end?
At the end, there's
Bear Box.
Bear Box is you have some EFI x86 based architecture. With EFI, and that's some new stuff because we want to add EFI support into the Bearbox bootloader. So you can, it was mostly for embedded systems like ARM and PowerPC and something else, but we want to support also UEFI for Bearbox to booting Linux.
Why would you do that?
Because we want to replace group 2.
And you want UEFI?
No, because I don't want it, but companies build motherboards.
You're right, okay, I understand. Yep. Okay, thank you very much. Is there anything else that I missed that I should have asked? Because I have a few. I'm too distracted by the cool lights here. Anything that you want to tell us or that's coming up in the next year that you're going to be releasing or that you want help with?
My part is more about 6LoWPAN stuff. I'm the Linux kernel maintainer of the stuff, and maybe somebody wants to help, and there exists a mailing list on the vgr.kernel.org.
Okay.
On the regular mailing list, and our project is their Linux WPAN.
Thank you very much for the interview. We're at the Java Card Pro booth. And your name is?
Hello, my name is Martin Paljak.
And what is Java Card Pro?
So Java Card Pro is basically an umbrella project of different software utilities to make Java Card, specifically smart card programming, more accessible to new developers.
Now, by smart card, you mean something with a SIM chip, like the old traditional we have in the Netherlands, where you can pay with a chip and pen?
Right. So a smart card, basically, it's either with a chip, with a codec interface, or... these days, Java cards also have an NFC interface, so they can use the mobile phones, or, for example, emulate an NFC tag. It's all possible with Java cards. So the main difference, what I've been showing here today to people and yesterday to people, has been showing it. Well, they don't obviously see it right now, but
I'll take a photo and put it in the show notes.
Okay. What's the difference between a small a static NFC tag where you can write like an URL or phone number or some text onto, and a programmable smart card? So when the information coming from an NFC tag is static, the same URL which right there, the information coming from a programmable tag is, well, programmable, which means you can generate content on the fly. For example, you can add OTP tokens to the... URLs you generate, or you can give like a random Chinese fortune cookie whenever you touch the phone, touch the card with the phone, or, and I mean, the possibilities are endless. And
but you can't do that with the NFC ones?
No, that's not possible, because it's just static. You can store a few hundred bytes of information to an NFC tag, but from a card, I mean, the limits are much, much higher.
Okay.
Yeah.
So, why?
Why? It's a good question. I mean, it is an open source developers conference, right? So why here? as I said, my goal is to attract more developers to the smart card world. If developers to this day take smart cards as a static piece of hardware with a fixed firmware where you cannot, you know, do anything, then actually there's a whole world of, you know, tiny applications yet to be discovered by many developers. It's fun.
Well, as far as I can see, most of the development for smart card stuff is in the fraud space.
Is in the fraud space. Oh yeah, well yes, of course. And you can also programmable cards are also handy when you're doing like pen testing or just for security research. There are its uses. Some are malicious. Some are maybe a bit gray. But anyway. It's like with any other development thing, you can use it and you can abuse it. So you can use it for good things.
So when you say it's programmable, what can I do with this card that I'm holding up?
Well, you can, first of all, you don't have to actually program anything yourself. It's like open source. There is a bunch of existing applications available from GitHub, for example.
Applications, you mean?
Like Java card applications, stuff you can actually install inside the chip of the smart card.
When is that? And that will run when the reader gives it power, is it?
Yes, that's correct.
What sort of things?
So, people have been, which is very commonly asked for is, hey, I know that smart cards are used for cryptography. I can store my private keys on it, like for SSH and PGP. But that is not all you can do. Like I said, you can generate NFC tags. You can program them to, for example, give you access tokens for a Wi-Fi, for example. No. Think about it. It's you're a coffee shop, and you have an open Wi-Fi. Everybody can connect, but they can't really get anywhere unless they go inside physically to the coffee shop. There's a sign on the wall saying "Touch here with the phone for internet access," and it's actually physically bound to the card. If you give a password, if the lady at the counter gives you a password, you can give the password to someone else. But that is physically guaranteed that you have to be physically there to touch the access token, which gives you, let's say, access for 1 hour.
Yeah, but that's for NFC, but those are not programmable. You just put a piece of text
on
there.
No, I mean, that's the idea, that if you have a programmable NFC tag, you can generate the access tokens programmatically.
Yeah, but then everybody has to have a reader in their computers.
In their mobile phones. But, I mean, these days, I guess all the newer mobile phones do have NFC by default. So,
what you're saying on this card, this programmable card, you can communicate with it over NFC?
Yeah, sure.
Ah, right. Now I understand.
Okay.
So this NFC tag that you put onto stickers, that's just dumb. It's got a number on it. But this I can change.
Yeah, I mean, you can change also the NFC stickers.
You can
overwrite it, yeah.
But here I could look for your particular MAC address and then give you a particular code.
Yeah, well, you actually need to combine it to the backend service. But basically, yes, you can do these types of stuff. Because, I mean, it's dynamically generated based on your program. You can do OTP tokens, basically, you know, physical authentication. And what to do with this information in the backend is totally up to you, which this is just one example that you can use for Wi-Fi.
So you'd have these, maybe three of these readers on the walls around the coffee shop, and you go up and you tap on that and you're done.
No, this is just an example.
Any other cool, how big are the programs that you can put on there? How complex do they get?
How do you measure complexity? So from as a programmer's point of view,
if it's awesome.
Okay, from programmer's point of view, the application size is usually, let's say, a few hundred to a few thousand, not more than 3,000-4,000 lines, which actually the application size is, 10, 15, 20, 25 kilobytes. Well, yeah, there are cards with varying EEPROM sizes, starting from 32 kilobytes up to 150 and even 320. So, the different cards available from different vendors have different capabilities, like different EEPROM sizes. So you can actually choose your target platform based on your actual requirements.
So you could have a home access system on steroids for yourself.
Well, if that's your goal, then yes. I mean, my idea is to facilitate developers. I don't really care what they do with it. So.
Okay, cool. So what do I need I need some hardware to start. What do I need? Where do I get it?
Right, so...
this is where you introduce your company.
No, I'm a software guy. So what you do need is a standard smart card reader.
Yeah.
If you have one, like here in Belgium, people have an ID card, which is also basically a smart card, so they very often already have a smart card reader. Or like an NFC reader, which tends to be more expensive, and, well, obviously doesn't work with cards that do not have NFC capabilities. And you need a Java card. So there are plenty of Java cards available these days from different vendors of the internet. So you can order cards starting ranging from 5 euros of cheap Chinese ones up to, let's say, 30 euros or so for very advanced, latest technology, let's say, Western Java cards with high cryptographic capabilities of like elliptic curves and, you know, huge key sizes and so on. And you need the open source software that's available from javacard.pro.
On what license do you release that under?
It varies depending on... basically, it's a mix of GPL, LGPL, and MIT. So usually it's so that the software that goes, that's provided by the project, that goes into the card is licensed, mid-licensed, because that's the only sensible license for such an application. But the host-side software... is either GPL or LGPL if it has roots in some projects that are LGPL, but most of my code, which I write myself, is MIT.
Thank you very much, and enjoy the rest of the show.
Thank you.
I'm down here talking to
Siobhan.
Hi.
And Siobhan, you, you're knitting, so... we just had a quick conversation there, and I thought, okay, let's just record some stuff here. You were telling me that there's a knitting group here in Fostem.
They're on Ravelry.com, which has a number of sub-communities, known as groups. There is a Fostem knitters group. So I can see from here at least one other person who is knitting.
Yeah.
Somebody showed me a picture of a T-shirt today which said knitting, coding since the 11th century. It's what it is. We have knit and purl. You have digital has one and zero. Everything is made up from two elements. And if that sounds familiar to anybody who is a geek, then it probably should. If you're interested in anything to do with knitting, crochet, spinning, dyeing, get to Ravelry.com. If you're interested in knitting tutorials online, which are little videos that you can watch over and over again, that's knittinghelp.com. And all of this is free. And there's a huge crossover between between hacking and knitting. There's knitted wearables. Netflix in the last month or so revealed patterns for socks which you can customize for your favorite shows, which have embedded in them electronics which will turn off the program when you go to sleep. You're binge watching Walking Dead, you fall asleep, your socks pause the show. That pattern's available free.
Excellent.
So there's a huge...
That's a first world problem, you have to admit.
There's a huge crossover, and get in touch with us through Ravelry. And happy knitting.
Thank you. As we were talking there, you were knitting. Are you counting as you were going along? How do you do... is your brain capable? I don't know if my brain would be capable of doing that.
I've done this movement in my lifetime several million times.
And you know this because...
I know this because I learned to crochet when I was 4. By then, I could already knit. So I've been knitting all my life. I knit. A day would rarely go by when I didn't pick up needles. So I have extremely refined muscle memory for this sort of thing. I can carry on a conversation easily. I can watch television easily. More complicated stuff, you needs a bit more concentration, but that's the same with any activity. Most people can write their signature without looking at the page. And it's because they've done
it. If you
tie your shoelaces, you can learn to do this.
Awesome stuff. Thank you very much.
Listening to Hacker Public Radio at hackerpublicradio.org. We are a community podcast network that releases shows every weekday, Monday through Friday. Today's show, like all our shows, was contributed by an HBR listener like yourself. If you ever thought of recording a podcast, then click on our contribute link to find out how easy it really is. Hacker Public Radio was founded by the Digital Dog Pound and the Infonomicon Computer Club and is part of the Binary Revolution at binrev.com. If you have comments on today's show, please email the host directly, leave a comment on the website, or record a follow-up episode yourself. Unless otherwise stated, today's show is released under a Creative Commons Attribution ShareAlike 3.0 license.